Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor from Football 365, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. Manchester City's appeal against a two-year ban from the Champions League will dominate the week. It isn't a normal sporting disciplinary issue. It gives us a glimpse into the future of football itself. On the one hand, we have UEFA fighting to reassert its authority. On the other, we have City, a state-supported club with global influence and aspirations. Both sides have requested confidentiality for the three-day hearing in Switzerland. Both sides have spared no expense in assembling high-profile legal teams. The stakes couldn't be higher. Now, Seb, this could be as game-changing as the Bosman ruling, couldn't it?
More so, perhaps, Mike. For UEFA, if UEFA were to lose this decision, you wonder where their authority is. I mean, obviously, we're heading for some kind of restructure anyway. I think that's the kind of the macro aim for the game in the long term. But given that UEFA have kind of pushed all their chips into the middle of the table here, and, you know, of all the sort of the leaked documents that implicate Manchester City, I think it insinuates a fairly dogged attitude from UEFA themselves. They are determined to punish City. They knew that going down this road would lead to the reaction that it has provoked. And so it becomes a sort of winner-takes-all scenario. I mean, it's almost not worth thinking about what would happen if... I mean, it's not about any kind of insinuation of guilt on Man City's part. It's just that if UEFA lose, then what do UEFA mean? I mean, in the ideological sense, what is UEFA's purpose from that point? What is the value of not just FFP, but their entire stance on the game? So if they do lose, it almost creates a blank canvas, doesn't it? It creates a situation where the body charged with ruling the game in Europe no longer really has any authority, which is a very strange sentence to say. I almost can't believe I'm actually saying it, but that's the result potentially.
But Manchester City, didn't they? They basically part of their reaction to the charge initially was that they accused UEFA of being judge, jury, and executioner over their own competition, which I think to most sane people would, you know, it's their competition, it's their rules. If you are, deemed to have broken them,
hey, then... I would say, sorry, mate. I say, well, what do they expect? I mean, who are? This is not government, really, in the political sense. This is
what separation
of power do people expect to exist within a UEFA competition?
Yeah, and that makes your point very relevant, because if UEFA were to lose and therefore their authority over their own competition, their own rules is effectively quashed. Yeah, it's carte blanche, isn't it, for anyone to do whatever they wish. And it's very, very dangerous. It's going to be fascinating to find out. I just wish it wouldn't take so long because, Mike, obviously there are a number of teams chasing fifth place now, aren't there? Which is not normally something we discuss in great detail. But there will be a number of teams with the eye on the prize of fifth. I think it's only fair and right that they should know ahead of the end of the season whether that is going to earn a Champions League place or not. But these things drag on, don't they?
Yeah. Well, the hearing's due to last for 3 days. Now, the word is that it might take a couple of months to actually reach the verdict. And I suppose, as you said, Aid, that's not fair on anyone, including the team that finishes fifth, especially including the team that finishes fifth. You know, all we know is that the hope is that the verdict will be reached before the round of 16, the current round of 16, resumes in August. I suppose we have to say that Ferran Soriano, Manchester City's chief executive, has said the clubs will bring, and I quote, irrefutable evidence that the claims aren't true. But I just want to look at the bigger picture, both at a club level, in terms of what this would do potentially to Manchester City. But the big picture, we've talked about Super Leagues, we've talked about big clubs getting bigger. I suppose if UEFA lose this, the whole principle of financial fair play will be unenforceable, won't it?
You'd have thought so. I mean, financial fair play is... Now, just before we go on, let's clarify this. I don't think financial fair play is an unambiguously good thing for the game. I think there are arguments for and against it. I think it entrenches positions.
And City will say that it's basically the status quo, which doesn't really want to include them.
And I would say back to them that that's all well and good, but it's what you signed up to. So making arguments about the virtues of financial fair play after you've been accused of breaching its regulations is not really, it's kind of disingenuous. But what's the question, Mike? Sorry.
Well, the question is, where are we going with this in terms of, you know, we are getting to a stage where football will become the Wild West and the sheriffs will be vastly expensive lawyers who, you know, I've been flooding into Switzerland as we speak. So that is the problem, isn't it? That you know, any game, the game of football depends on people accepting a central form of authority, which is being challenged completely here.
But isn't the natural repercussion, though, that into the vacuum left potentially by UEFA's defeat, a different body, a body which is built out of the interests of the major clubs, develops, and that takes its place. That's my fear, because that becomes the kind of, that's like a, you know, like a parliamentary coup. You know, eventually the people just accept it because that is the natural order of things. And so that's probably what I think would happen.
Well, that's inevitable, isn't it? You know, I think that will happen if City win.
On look at the EFL at the moment. The EFL are effectively ruled by the clubs. And what a mess they are making of this situation. The clubs themselves, obviously, are looking over their own interests. And of course, that is what we're looking at in terms of the future of the highest level of football if we go down that route. You know, I sincerely hope it doesn't happen. On FFP, by the way, Mike, I can't see in the short term post-pandemic how it can exist, really. And in a strange way, because everyone's finances will be so different and the losses incurred will be so huge that I just think you kind of need to recalibrate over a period of time. But the irony here is that actually football will need the clubs that are owned by the states, clubs like City, like, you know, others, PSG, well, you know, wealthy individual owners like Roman Abramovich. Football needs them to pump some money back into the game, doesn't it? To kickstart the football economy. So the very people that FFP has been designed to sort of curb and limit, I can't see how they can't now say, come on, please start spending some money so we can generate that, you know, that football economy again. Strange times.
It is. And you know, I think probably what we've got to accept is that, you know, City's global model with, I think it's nine at the last count, nine clubs at the last count, eventually will have greater commercial and strategic power than the authorities that we've come to recognise over the years, especially, you know, as you said, Seb, in some sort of Super League breakaway culture. I just want to turn it on its head. What happens if City fail to overturn the sanction, which is, you know, as we better say, it's pretty unprecedented. It's alongside a 30 million euro fine, which I know is, you know, that can be found on the back of a sofa in the City these days. But the whole point of what this will happen, you know, what will happen here to City? Will we have player migration? What impact would it have, do you think, on Pep Guardiola's future? Or would it give the club a cause to rally around? What do you think?
I think a little bit of both. In terms of a cause to rally around, I think we're already seeing that. I know we're going to get to this, but the sort of the reaction of supporters and the kind of reaction to adversity culture, the kind of the victimization that comes with sort of an authority targeting a club. With Guardiola, I don't know, because I mean, my instinct would say that sort of without the opportunity to win a European Cup, why is Guardiola there? You can make a case for saying that he wants to kind of reclaim his primacy from Jurgen Klopp. That's fair. But then also, you know, if he were to leave, where would he actually go to? So without a landing spot for Guardiola, there's no exit strategy. Financially, it was probably a bit easier to answer this question 3 or 4 months ago when we didn't have a pandemic to deal with. But obviously, every club in the country, no matter what they're backed by, no matter whether they have a sovereign wealth fund in their corner or not, there is going to be an implication from lost revenue. So it's going to be really interesting. I suspect, actually, I mean, do we really think that both years are going to stand up? It just seems much more likely. And I don't know whether this is kind of past precedent speaking, but in this situation, it always seems like one of these years becomes suspended and it becomes a sort of the initial judgment, the end judgment becomes an exercise in compromise. So it really wouldn't surprise me to see that and to see this sort of the punishment scaled back.
No, and that I think will be the deciding factor for a number of the players. If I was to put myself in Kevin De Bruyne's shoes, for example, he's 28. Could he swallow 1 year without Champions League football to continue his sort of legacy at Man City? I think he
probably
could. Yeah, exactly. But two, takes him to 30. He'd be 31 the time he gets back in the Champions League. Yeah, that's a big decision for him to make. And he's already alluded to that. Guys like Sterling and Laporte and Bernardo and Edison, they're still young enough, I think, to take the fact that 1 year that they could be out of it. So I don't think there'd be a huge exodus. I personally was convinced that Pep would leave City, possibly at the end of this season, if it had finished normally. I actually feel that because of the current scenario, it almost makes it impossible for him to move on. And I don't think he would want to leave City in the lurch like that. And obviously he's in the process of appointing a new number two at the moment, which is a really positive sign for Guardiola and his future. So yeah, I think if it's knocked down to a year on appeal, it won't really impact Manchester City's squad too much at all.
Yeah, I do sense, Aidan, since you've mentioned it, that this move to appoint a new assistant will be very significant. Wanmar Lilo is someone that Guardiola has respected, almost a mentor in a coaching sense. He played for him in Mexico, pretty much unpaid, for about 5 or 6 months. He's seen as a key coaching influence. He's credited, I think Rory Smith wrote about it, as a pioneer of 4-2-3-1, that, you know, Rafa Benitez especially has talked very warmly about him. Well, it suggests to me one of two things. One, that Pep has a longer term commitment, or two, he's quietly getting into place a succession plan and Lilo will be his successor.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I genuinely don't think there's anything on his managerial CV to suggest that he's good enough or the right man to lead Manchester City post Guardiola. I just genuinely think he needs a new right-hand man. Mikel Arteta, it's a long, long time since he left and he hasn't filled that post. And the longer that went on, the more speculation would grow that he would leave. So I just think he needs someone he can trust by his side in the short term. Now, what is short term? I think it's at least, you know, to the end of next season. That's how I would see it. The other factor here is he calls him the maestro, doesn't he? So he absolutely loves him to bits. The risk here, and I've been in dressing rooms where they've changed the number two. And number twos don't get talked about a great deal in the wider discussions about football. But they're really important people. And players tend to have closer relationships with the number two than they do with the gaffer. And it's a critical appointment because will the players take to him? I think every time you employ someone in that position, it's a slight gamble. Will they take to him? Will they like his training sessions? Will they bond with him? Or they trust him? And these are all unknowns. I'm sure it'll be fine, but that change comes with a degree of risk.
Guys, I think he's there to challenge Guardiola too, intellectually. So you remember when he was on his sabbatical, there were all those anecdotes about him playing chess with Garry Kasparov. He's that in this context. He's someone that he... And I must apologise to listeners as the guy cutting the grass outside goes past on his on his mower. These are things we have to tolerate at the moment. I'm sorry about that. He's there as
it doesn't as sound somewhat, like a fly mow.
No, I tell you, it's not. He's doing the communal garden, and he is going. He's about a foot away from my living room window, so it shakes the house when he goes past. So goodness knows what it does for the podcast quality. I mean, all the anecdotes about their relationship in the past involve their debates. you know, and the discussions, the hugely in-depth discussions about the game and the culture of the game and the evolution of the game. There, because it's an interesting time to bring him in. I mean, they're close, but he's also, Lilo's coming at a time when Guardiola needs that kind of challenge, because he's got a little bit of a conundrum on his hands. He doesn't have an answer for what Jurgen Klopp has brought to the Premier League. His Manchester City are clearly at the moment inferior to what Liverpool have been in tone, in structure, in effect, in all kinds of things. Klopp has done what Guardiola has failed to do in winning the European Cup. So Lilo comes in and sort of, he's almost a sort of a figure of disruption, isn't he? He's almost someone that comes in and, you know, can sort of mentor him on the job. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's just someone. Yeah. He's a disruptor, isn't he?
And that
in the
can
kind
be
of conciliatory sense.
And it will cause one or two ructions, no doubt about it, behind the scenes. And it will, but it might perk Pep up a little bit. And you know, just when he's feeling like, you know, what can I do? I'm out of ideas here. He brings in this guy, like you say, to challenge him and to renew his energy levels and the energy levels of his players. Give the players belief. Ah, something new is here. Something fresh.
Exactly.
Just to give them that lift in their quest to win the Champions League and to catch Liverpool up. So no, he had to do it, and it sounds like a wise choice, but a lot of it will depend on how the players respond to this guy.
Yeah. Okay. I don't really want to dwell too much on the reaction of the City fans, because I don't think it's desperately helpful. You know, they spent £8,000 on, you know, what is pretty much an infantile anti-UEFA banner. So I just want to go beyond that now and look at actually the financial implications of the COVID crisis, because it seems to me that they are becoming very clear now. You've had Spurs taking out a £175 million loan to tide them over. Conversely, you've got Chelsea benefiting once again from Roman Abramovich's wealth and willingness to fund signings. Do you think in that context, the signing of Timo Werner is good business?
Yeah, I do think it's good business. Yeah, I can't see the downside. Morata's on his way out, isn't he, to Atletico?
It's pretty much, I think they're going to get 48 million for him from Atletico. So it's 5 or 6 million. Yeah.
Yeah, in that sense, it's really good business. You know, for Werner, a younger, more exciting player at the moment than Morata. So no, it's good for them. They're flexing their muscles and their recruitment, I would imagine, is getting the Blues fans really, really excited. Ziyech is a really, really talented footballer, isn't he? He will add something to the squad. And Werner fills one big hole, because they've lacked a finisher this season, Chelsea. Abraham has exceeded everybody's expectations. He's done fantastically well. But ultimately, I'm still not convinced that he is a number one for Chelsea, certainly not as the principal lone striker. Maybe we'll see them pair up as a two, or Werner will play to, you know, wide of him, or even down the middle on his own. So it's a signing they needed. And I was really interested in regards to, you can talk about the wealth of Roman and that one, that's obvious. But also the youth of Lampard, I think, came into play. He's recently retired. He knows what makes modern players tick. And I think he's done an excellent job, by all accounts, of selling himself, the club, the vision, to the player himself. He knows the value of that personal touch. And I think that has smoothed the passage for this transfer to happen. So, yeah, well played, Chelsea, is what I'd say for this piece of business.
Yeah, they're certainly getting their business done early, aren't they, Seb? It looks like Leicester are ready to demand around about £65 million for Ben Chilwell. You know, on the simple premise, a bit like, you know, Maguire and Man United, that Chelsea will stump up the money. Do you think, one, that Chilwell is worth that sort of money in this climate? And two, are clubs like Leicester going to profit from the, you know, unquenchable ambitions of the top clubs?
I think so. I think the key ingredient for a club like Leicester is that they aren't, you know, the old model of a club in their position was to kind of, it's almost like they couldn't stand to be asked the same question three times. He's not for sale, he's not for sale. Oh, go on then. Okay. And Leicester have kind of have broken that mold. The Maguire example is perfect, Mike, because it was at the beginning of summer. No, he's going to cost X. And, you know, Manchester United spent 6 weeks sort of trying to haggle or negotiate or whatever. And then by the end of the summer, it was still the same price was still due. And I like it. I think that their attitude seems to be that they're aware of Chelsea's interest. I think everyone's aware of Chelsea's interest. But, you know, if you don't meet the price tag, you're not having the player. The real virtue of their situation is that they've built a project which, you know, maybe someone like Ben Chilwell might be happy to leave for Chelsea, but he wouldn't be desperate to leave, would he? I mean, he's on the brink of becoming England's first choice left back full time. He's playing with a group of players who are of a similar age who, by all accounts, he gets on very well with, and for a manager that they're reacting to very positively. So you don't have a lot of the pressures that used to exist. Leicester is a very good place to be at the moment. And that is, you know, there's no leverage in that for a club like Chelsea or any other, you know, Man City, Man United. So it depends who's negotiating, Mike, I think.
And really, what about Man City? If Man City were to come in for Chilwell, and we're led to believe that they're interested as well, would that tempt him more, potentially? I think as a player, it might, with me, the opportunity to work with Pep, you'd think City would stand more chance of, not just, well, actually, I suppose at the moment, in light of what we've talked about, are they going to be in the Champions League? Would you leave a club like Leicester, who are almost certain to be in the Champions League, for a club that may not be in it next year? So that is the argument against moving to City, I guess. Personally, I think he's a very accomplished left back, but I don't think he's a special left back, I'm afraid. I don't think I've seen enough of him to suggest that he can be a rampaging, you know, Alphonso Davies type superstar down the left going forward. Defensively, I don't think he's Ashley Cole standard in the tackle in terms of his defensive nose. He's good at everything, but is he great at either aspect of fullback play? I'm not completely sold on it. I like him as a player. I think that he's excellent. He's international standard, that's for sure. He's worth a place in the England squad. But I don't know if he's worth that kind of money. And on Chelsea's point of view, they've got two very attack-minded left backs that can't defend. We know that. So he would improve them there. But Alonso is a lot better inside the final third, in my opinion, than Ben Chilwell, who has got into a habit, I think, this season of just checking back, playing the safe pass. And I think that's caused a little bit of frustration, actually, at the King Power Stadium. That he's not been as dynamic as they think he can be. So, yeah, look, he's a very good player, but I don't know if he's a special left back.
Yeah, I suppose Jurgen Klopp talked this week about, you know, how can football clubs preach prudence and sacrifice to their players if they spend 50 million plus on a player and pay him 200 grand a week. There was an element, because that came after Timo Werner going to Chelsea, of, you know, didn't fancy that girlfriend very much anyway. But I suppose, as unpalatable as it seems, Seb, was Gareth Bale's agent, Jonathan Barnett, right when he said that player wages would be unaffected by the crisis?
I think that refers to a very select group of players. I think a sort of a Gareth Bale type of player that exists in the sort of in the game stratosphere. Yes, that's probably true, because a lot of the things, you know, forget their value to football clubs, a lot of their kind of marketing potential and their value to sort of, you know, it beyond the game, I think that remains unaffected. You can still use a Neymar and a Messi or Ronaldo to sell sportswear or, you know, luxury watches or, you know, sports cars, that kind of thing. So, you know, those things remain true. I think the middle class will suffer. I think they'll be squeezed. I think the idea that you can, as a, you know, a 7 out of 10 Europa League player, demand 130, 150 grand a week, I think those days are not over. But I think, you know, we might have to, you know, scale that back a little bit, because I think in when they come to negotiate that kind of contract, clubs will look at two things. Firstly, basic wage, of course, but also length of contract. Because do you, with the sort of the knowledge of what a pandemic can do or what a crisis can do, and importantly, the understanding that football is actually not invulnerable to everything in the world, you're going to come out with a lot of clubs at the end of it who are a lot more cautious, who are a lot keener to protect their interests and a lot keener to not put themselves at risk in the same way again. With regards to Jonathan Barnett individually, I mean, it's hard to accept his version of events as a kind of universal truth, because the way he negotiates for his clients is fairly unique.
and very successful.
Yes and no. I would argue in Bale's case, no. I mean, Gareth Bale is an extremely wealthy young man, yes. Could Gareth Bale's career have benefited in a sort of a legacy sense if he'd taken a slight pay cut and moved somewhere else over the last few years? I'd argue yes. I'd argue that maybe his agent has been both his best friend and his worst enemy at times. That's just a personal opinion. I think that the way his career has been handled will affect how Gareth Bale is remembered in 10, 20 years' time. I think that's almost certainly true. But yeah, his basic point is right, Mike. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I think you used the right phrase in saying middle-class players, they're the ones that suffer. I think the youngsters will be kept on, they'll be the cheapest. The clubs will always want to look after their best players, their highest earners. It's those in the middle that will suffer. And I do think that there'll be new clauses, won't there, in contracts moving forwards that guarantee that the clubs are protected for things like this.
They'll be selling new degrees for that, Adrian. Like in a couple of years, you'll have to study for a year just to write those specific clauses about sort of pandemic insurance and whatever else.
Yeah. Watching football over the weekend, the Bundesliga, I'd be interested to see what your reactions were to the artificial crowd noise on the red button. You know, I watched a couple of games and I was prepared, to be honest, to absolutely hate it. But I thought it was really cleverly done. I think it did add to the buzz of the atmosphere. And you know, there were occasional jarring sort of sights when you heard the buzz of the crowd and you looked and it was just, you know, empty seats. But I thought it was really good. What do you think, guys?
I like it. I mean, yeah, we talked about it a couple of times on this podcast. I'm in favour of it. I would use it. But I do think that the viewers should have a choice. I think that it should be A or B. Do you want the crowd noise or not? Because it isn't authentic, is it? And I think that we as viewers have the right to have the real thing, so to speak. But personally, for enjoyment purposes, I prefer to have that little bit of a buzz there. It just feels more normal. And it makes me forget that in effect it looks like a training game. So yeah, for me. And also, obviously, a lot of my work is as a co-commentator. And when you are co-commentating on a game, and I've done a few in the Checkatrade Trophy or the Leasing.com, as it's called now, and I've done it on the radio, and it's hard because when no one's getting that excited inside the stadium because there's not many people there, it's hard to generate that excitement around a goal and you're a little bit more toned down in your reactions. And that's a bit alien to me because I like to be passionate and sort of get into the games naturally. And I don't want to feel like I've got to hold back. So yeah, for me personally, as a co-commentator, I would have it in my ears. I would choose to have crowd noise in my ears because it feels more authentic. And actually, you know, hopefully I'm going to get some work on the radio in the coming weeks and months. I wonder whether radio might, because obviously it's one or the other. I don't think there'll be a choice there. I'm not sure how they can do that. Will they choose to have crowd noise? Because I think for the listener, it would enhance it for the majority personally, rather than hearing, you know, the screams and shouts of individual players. So that'd be an interesting development.
Yeah, what struck me was the subtlety and the cleverness of it. And that did surprise me, to be honest, especially, you know, when goals went in, if it was an away goal, the reaction was a little bit more muted than it would be when a home goal went in. As I said, I was really surprised, Seb, and I'm prepared to accept it, where I didn't think I would be, to be perfectly honest. What about you?
Well, I'm a stubborn man, as you know, Mike. but in this instance, we couldn't get it to work, so I'm not really... what I will say is I've been watching a lot of Australian Rugby League to fill the void, and they've got it as a default. You don't have to select it as an option, and it works very well. And it's interesting you mentioned the kind of the nuance of the noise, and that really surprised me too. I thought it'd be like, do you remember like computer games early in the 90s where you had sort of just generic sound? And so I thought that kind of when goals would go in, it would sound like, I don't know, like an episode of Funhouse with Pat Sharp or something like that, you know. But it's actually been done very well. And with football, I'm yet to work that out. But as and when I do, I'm encouraged by what I hear from everybody
on that, by the way, I don't think I'm divulging anything
on Pat Sharp's Funhouse.
No, fond memories. Look, I have worked on games off tube. Okay, so you're not always at the game. It's a little trick of the radio, just for various reasons, especially if it's an overseas game, You might be commentating on it from a studio in London, for example, and you have the natural sound effects, but there is always a provision there for if the sound effects drop off from the stadium and you have a generic crowd noise. And I've commentated on games with that before, and it can be disconcerting because it just doesn't go with the action that you're commentating on. What I think worked well with BT, and I think it will work in the Premier League as well, is you've got a controller. You've got someone that's pressing the right buttons at the right time to sync it with the action. And that is the trick, I think, to making it palatable for football supporters.
Good. Well, you know, we're all looking forward to the restart. Not long now. We've been talking about most valuable players at clubs. Go through the next batch if we could. Quite a heavyweight group, to be honest. Starting at Manchester City, I'm looking for Aymeric Laporte to actually basically hold them together at the back. I think he's been their most reliable defender, pretty much an instant success there. And I suppose when he was injured, you know, you usually do work out how valuable people are by the chaos that's left behind them. So I think he's really, really good. Raheem Sterling, again, you know, we look at the papers today, he's talking about much broader issues than Manchester City and even the Champions League ban. He's talking about fundamental social issues. I think he'll come through again as well. So who will you be looking for maybe beyond those two?
Well, first of all, I really agree with you. I mean, Laporte is the only defender there that you trust. I mean, he's not only an excellent defender, he's a real threat from set pieces in the other box too. But I'm going to pick Kevin De Bruyne, Mike. I don't think that needs much explanation. I think he is, for me anyway, the most complete player in the league. I love watching Kevin De Bruyne. I love his range of abilities. I love the idea that what was previously a fairly static number 10 skill set has become this kind of very dynamic footballing aesthetic. I think he's a fabulous player. I just hope that as and when the league comes back, he is fit, because there is a big difference between a kind of a half-fit Kevin De Bruyne and a fully fit one, and there's a big difference to Man City. If he's fit, it makes the world a difference because, you know, they've still got an FA Cup to win, obviously.
Yeah, not much more to add on that, really. Yeah, with Sterling, I think he had gone a bit off the boil. Maybe the break will have done him good. I'm looking forward to seeing him hit the ground running. I actually have a feeling he might. I think he's going to be a real threat.
Yeah, let's look across Manchester at United, Aid. You know, Marcus Rashford had missed, lest we forget, I think it was 9 matches before the lockdown. Here's someone who I think is growing into his role and responsibilities both on and off the pitch. I expect him to come back with a bang. What about you?
I really like him as a person. Seems so, so well brought up. He's just an all-round good egg, isn't he, Marcus Rashford? And United are so much better with him in the team. So, yeah, no, looking forward to seeing how he fares, I guess, after this break. I hope he's fully fit. Obviously, the Pogba-Bruno Fernandes axis, will they play together, won't they? That will be fascinating to see unfold. I would pick out someone to watch, keep your eye on, would be the keeper, David De Gea. I think there are elements to suggest that this season, again, he's dipped. Is he shot? Is he ever going to recapture the brilliance? Let's face it, he was unreal for several campaigns for Manchester United. For me at the time, the best keeper in the world. He's not that anymore. And he's making a lot of mistakes. And he's a difference maker for Manchester United. If he can somehow recapture his best form, United will pick up the points they need to potentially overtake a Chelsea. So I think he's really, really crucial. I've got a feeling that he might eventually be sold on. I think that Henderson could apply enough pressure for them to make that change, especially if he doesn't perform well over the coming weeks.
I'm going to go left field when we're looking at Newcastle, Seb. I'm going to say that Steve Bruce could be the MVP simply because so much of the focus will be on him. We all know what happens when ownership changes and, you know, who knows, they might eventually get round to sorting something out up there. It's really unfair, but it is understandable that all the attention will be on him, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reality is, Mike, is that Steve Bruce could win the Premier League, the Champions League, the League Cup and the FA Cup, and they'll still get rid of him. because that's just how it works, I'm afraid. That's, you know, I think that this sort of, it sounds very, very harsh and unfair, and it is in many ways. But if the takeover goes ahead, then sort of the best situation that he can hope for is to come out with his dignity intact. And I think he's more than capable of doing that. But it will get very boring very, very quickly in press conferences. I know those in themselves aren't going to be very, very normal for a while, but yeah. He is going to be asked that question an awful lot about, you know, whichever name du jour is being floated in the press that morning. Can I pick out Joe Ellington, actually, Mike, for Newcastle? Because I think there's a player there. I mean, Newcastle are going to survive. But I think kind of if he uses this remaining bit of the season to prove that he is not necessarily a £40 million player, but just a capable goal scorer in this league, then hopefully as and when funds are available, they can build some pieces around him, you know, to build a little bit of an attacking platform for him to operate from. I'd be interested. I don't think he's as hopeless as people say he is.
Well, what about Norwich, Aid? Yeah, it's a club that I think is run terrifically well. I think Emi Buendia is one of those players who will be sold on if they get relegated. I think he's too valuable to go back to the Championship. I think he's becoming a pretty much complete midfield player in many, many ways. Anyone there that you would put in the same category of someone who is too good to go down?
Max Aarons, I think, has proved his worth as a Premier League player. Took him a while to find his feet in the top flight, but he is very, very young still. And yeah, he's just a player with immense potential. Maybe not Alexander-Arnold potential, I don't know. It's difficult to say. But as soon as I saw Alexander-Arnold, I was really struck by him and how confident he was, how accomplished he was. And I get a similar feeling with Max Aarons. A lot of big teams will be after him. So yeah, he's the one that I'd pick out. But in terms of the influence for the team, most important player for the team right now in their bid to survive, aside from Buendia, it has to be Pukki. He is still their best centre forward, their best finisher by miles. All they need is a hot streak from Teemu Pukki, and it could bring them, you know, right back into the frame of surviving. So he, a lot rests on his shoulders, I think.
Yeah, I suppose if we're looking for the anti-individualism club, Sheffield United probably qualifies as that. Lys Mousset. Now, he's had no goals since, I think, the last one was against Wolves on December the 1st. But he's still tied as leading scorer with John Fleck, would you believe? But that, to me, you can look at that two ways. One, it could be a condemnation of that group that, you know, five goals is your leading goal scorer. But equally, it's about, that's a miracle of man management, isn't it? Where do you stand on Sheffield United, Seb? And who are the individuals that still, despite the collective culture that's gone on there, that stand out for you?
Where I stand is universally positive. I'm full of admiration for what Chris Wilder has done and for what that group of players has done. The thing that's missing from... Okay, so I take your point about the sort of the lack of a headline goal scorer there, Mike, but the thing people forget is that they've got the second best defensive record in the whole league. I mean, they've conceded less than a goal a game, which is an amazing achievement. Individually, like I don't think of them in that way. I think of them as a departmental side. I mean, we've talked about Henderson. Perhaps that's the only true individual in the team. But I think of the way that the different areas of the side have operated. So the midfield, I know John Lundstrom has had a bad patch over the last few months. But Fleck has been excellent. Ollie Norwood, I've loved watching. I've always thought Ollie Norwood could find a home somewhere in the Premier League. So it's lovely to see him actually get that chance. But the entire system has just worked so well. And also you've got the kind of the contribution of people that aren't quite in the side. Someone like, for instance, Ollie McBurnie. I think he's had a very positive first Premier League season, or first Premier League season proper. And the whole thing just works. I was lucky enough to see Sheffield United on the first day of the season back at Bournemouth. They played Bournemouth off the pitch. They were absolutely excellent. And it's kind of... it's very gratifying to see this happen, to see a kind of a victory for mechanics and not organisation in the blunt sense, but just good, well-coached football. And because that's what they are, and they are such testament to their manager's ability. And wouldn't it be great? I have my own little vested interest in this. I would love Sheffield United to qualify for the Champions League because so many people would hate it. So many people would hate it because it's sort of, you know, it's taken, what, 7 months for Chris Wilder to get, you know, praise in the sort of the mainstream sense. And he has done an amazing job. One of the best first seasons I've seen from a newly promoted side in the history of the Premier League, honestly.
I want to try and sort of bring things together now. And I'd like just to ask each of you to examine one particular issue. I think with Aid, I just want you to dwell, if you may, on what's going to happen at the lower levels of the game. You know, there is still this hint of ingrained selfishness that, you know, the Premier League have yet to offer any financial aid to the EFL despite government demands. And there's talk about cutting solidarity payments by 25% next year if this season's curtailed. But specifically, you mentioned it earlier on, you know, this whole League One, League Two decisions we made or confirmed on Tuesday, it does seem that they're going to basically decide things by points per game. And that means that the playoffs will be Wickham, Oxford, Portsmouth and Fleetwood. That's going to cause all sorts of ill feeling. And, you know, our learned friends might be getting involved yet again.
Ill feeling and resentment that could drag on for years and years, I'm afraid. Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs. I think the structure of the way the EFL is set up, where the clubs have so much power, has caused it, and also the lack of support from above. And we have touched on this quite a bit over recent weeks. You look at Germany, German top flight clubs, they put their hands in the pockets, they created a solidarity fund, and it saved tiers two and three, hasn't it? And you know, they're functioning, they're able to play on. I do feel pretty angry, really, that the Premier League clubs and the government and the PFA haven't pushed harder for this, haven't for the EFL themselves, that they haven't pushed hard enough to ask for it, because they need it to get their seasons done in the right and proper way. And also, let's be fair, to get themselves in a position where they can even contemplate starting next season. I mean, this is my thought for the day. What about next season for Leagues 1 and 2? It's the only way I can see them starting or even being able to take place is if the pandemic calms down to such a degree where you can bring in a certain number of fans into stadiums and spread them out, or they get this solidarity fund from above. I think there's a very, very real prospect, and it really hurts me to say it, that there'll be no League One or League Two season. They have to start contemplating the fact that they might not be able to afford to put on a campaign, because where is the money going to come from? How are they going to be able to fulfil players' contracts? Will there be, you know, hundreds and hundreds of footballers who have their contracts null and voided? We talk about leagues being null and voided. Could contracts be null and voided because there's no league to play in? And I'm talking about the National League here as well. I'm really worried about the National League, who are in a even worse state. You know, they don't everything is on a smaller scale there. There's so much to be concerned about, and they need help. They need help from above, and I desperately want to see it.
Yeah, I suppose, Seb, in a broader issue, you know, restructure is almost going on a daily basis at the moment, different ideas coming up in Scotland. That's raised the spectre of B teams, and it was a proposal by Rangers that both Rangers and Celtic put a B team at the third tier of a new three-tier Scottish system, which would be 14 clubs in the Premiership, 14 in the Championship, and 18 in a League One. You know, we've talked about the whole concept of B teams over the past few weeks. Where do you think it's going in Scotland? Do you think, because of the relative power, both politically and financially, of the old firm, that they would have got more chance of forcing something through like that up there?
Yeah, you'd have thought so. I mean, any time you hear about B teams or any of the any similar initiative, it always comes from a bigger club. It always comes from the, you know, from the top down. And that's why I hate it. Because I understand we're moving into a strange world where, you know, they're going to have to be some compromises, and you know, their ideas like B teams potentially have to be rethought within a different context. But I can't get over the instinct, which is that it serves nothing other than the needs of a bigger club. It allows the use of a league structure for the development of, you know, an existing, in Scotland's case, a duopoly. Hate it. Mike, can I bring up something else as well, just while I'm here? Just because I don't feel like it's been covered enough. As of June the 1st, Newcastle United took another direct debit payment for future season tickets. Now, not every club in the country, not every Premier League club in the country has behaved in a particularly dignified or admirable way. They all, however, have communicated what their position is with regards to refunds or, you know, deferred payments, that kind of thing, with the exception of Newcastle. I've been reading some of the local press, and by all accounts, you know, a lot of journalists up there have put questions to the club about, you know, what they plan to do with payments that were taken back in March for next season's season tickets in full, what they plan to do with payments for tickets which have already been rendered redundant by the COVID crisis, and also the bigger question of why are you taking money for events which, for all intents and purposes, don't actually exist. They will take place, but without crowds, and there is no, as far as I'm aware, there is no schedule for crowds returning this country. So for better or worse, I would really urge Newcastle United to start communicating, because whilst the prospective takeover is possibly an asterisk against, you know, whatever financial transactions can or cannot take place, there's no real case for, there's no real mitigation for not communicating that properly, because people are suffering. People are short of money, people are losing jobs, people are losing relatives. So I think that's, and let's not beat around the bush, I think that's an absolute disgrace. To not communicate and not to give people clarity on that issue, I think it's awful.
Yeah, here, I agree with that entirely. I'll end by just talking about the women's game, if I could. The season has been curtailed. Chelsea have been named champions, even though they were second in the table at the time of curtailment. That means 7 trophies under Emma Hayes. It's just reward for, you know, I think what is a hugely professional operation there. And it contrasts, I think, starkly with that of Liverpool, who've been relegated. And I just hope that's the wake-up call that the club needs, because I thought it was put well by Susie Rack, who's of The Guardian. She's a regular on our women's football podcasts. And she believes that Liverpool's Premier League title should be tarnished by the relegation of their women from the WSL. Now, I wouldn't go that far, but she's certainly got a point that Liverpool are at best, and I mean at best, guilty of taking their eye off the ball. If you look at their natural rivals, Chelsea, Arsenal, the Manchester clubs, they've all recognised the importance of the women's game and invested accordingly. They've moved beyond platitudes into professionalism in all its forms. Liverpool, once pioneers, let's not forget, are now treated like paupers. Their players are part-time, and the one club strategy is basically a sham. Now, it's a great community club that's acting against its traditions. I think the owners need to recognise their mistakes and their responsibilities to the women's team. Their women must never again be allowed to walk alone. So thanks to everyone for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast, and we hope to see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.